Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with actor and director Gillian Jacobs. Mike Birbiglia's film Don't Think Twice, about a New York improv troupe, was one of my favorite movies of last year. Towards the end, we see Samantha, one of its most talented members, in a solo sketch. She's all over the stage, playing multiple characters, and yet, no one has ever looked so alone. It's a stunning scene, all the more so when you learn that Gillian Jacobs, who plays Sam, had no improv training. But as you'll hear, she knew how it felt to be lonely. It came not just from being the only child of divorced parents who didn't fit in with her peers, but from feeling she couldn't tell anyone about one of the worst times in her life. Convinced by Juilliard that she had no talent for theater, but also convinced that she was stuck with acting, she pursued the lowbrow world of film and television. That's where she found her community, as Britta Perry on NBC's Community. Did I mention she had no comedy training either? Now you can watch her as the sex and drug addicted wrecking ball, Mickey Dobbs, on Love, Judd Apatow's Netflix series. It's one more role she didn't have much life training for, unless you count hard-won empathy. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Gillian.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Thank you for coming and doing this.
My pleasure.
We just met today. But first off, I really wanted to have you here because I think you're doing amazing work. I love Don't Think Twice. I think Love, which is your show on Netflix that Judd Apatow and Paul Russ created, it's an amazing show. I feel like with every successive project you do, it gets more real, more raw, more emotional. You can almost chart like the lack of makeup that you wear. Have you noticed that? Like.
Certainly on the first season of Love, I was like, can we get a little more concealer, maybe? They're like, no, we're actually going to add more dark circles under your eyes. So yeah, that was definitely, you have to let go of whatever vanity you have.
Yeah, but as viewers, we're so much the richer for it because what you're doing is, I mean, when I think of how far television has come, even in the span from when you started Community to right now, on the cusp of the second season of Love. There's just an emotional depth, and also there seems to be no studio notes whatsoever, you know, or no need for a character to be likable or to test well. Or it's fascinating the work you're doing, and I want to talk to you about that. And I also want to talk to you during my research. I read that you look for stuff that scares you.
Mm-hmm.
And you wrote a Lenny letter. And for people who don't know, Lenny is sort of a feminist website. And was it started by Lena Dunham?
Yeah, and Jenny Connor.
Yeah. Okay, well, you wrote this amazing letter. And you even said, in the spirit of doing things that scared you, it scared you to write a Lenny letter. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, explain what the parameters are of a Lenny letter.
Well, you know, when they started the newsletter, I wanted to write for them because in the spirit of trying to scare myself, I was trying to push myself beyond just acting into writing and trying to direct and produce. And then they were like, okay, great. Actually, we also want you to write one about your experience in college. I was like, ugh, okay. And it was a way more profound experience than I was expecting because writing the article, every time I would submit it to the editor, Jess Gross, she would write me back, but why? But why? But why did you do this? But why did you do that? And so it really sparked these very honest conversations between my mother and I because I had a really hard time in college. I was on probation, and I never told my mom. So my second semester of my sophomore year, I sort of had this looming thing of I could be cut at the end of the school year and none of my credits would transfer and I'd have to start all over again and it would have been really difficult, but I never told my mom. And so the editors were like, but why didn't you tell your mom? But what was that about? And so it really forced my mom and I to have these conversations about a period in time we'd never really talked about before. And, you know, she told me that she felt that I was very distant from her and that was hurtful, that I seemingly, you know, really disconnected from her. And I said, well, you always sort of I felt like overreacted to things, so I didn't want to tell you this because I thought you would make it worse for me.
And we should say that this was at Juilliard.
Yes.
Well, okay, yeah. So let's back up because I was fascinated by this letter. I read it 3 times.
Oh, wow.
And I think I took away from that, like, what a hard thing that you, as an only child, your parents were divorced, mm-hmm. and you're living in this little bubble with your mom, and you get to this place in college where it all kind of falls apart, mm-hmm. and it was fascinating to me. So, but just so people understand, how were you sort of different as a kid?
Well, certainly when I was in elementary school, I was one of the only kids with divorced parents. Like, you know, obviously as time went on, that became more common among my classmates, but I think I felt a little bit different because of that. My parents were also slightly older, although now they would be totally average parent age. And because I was an only child, I primarily spent my time with other adults.
Right.
And so they found me precocious, and they thought my interests in Shakespeare and Cole Porter and, you know, Katharine Hepburn were adorable. And they really encouraged me. But then I would go be around kids my own age, and I really didn't have a lot to talk about with them. And my mom was not very pop culture savvy, so because I didn't have older siblings to really tell me about music or movies or TV, I also always felt like I kind of didn't necessarily know what the kids were talking about.
Right.
I remember being at someone's house, and they were playing this game where you'd swim underwater, and someone would sing like a top 40 song, and we had to guess it. And I didn't know any of the songs, and I started crying. So I was like a kid, you know, who didn't see a lot of the movies that everybody else my age has seen, and didn't really, you know, my mom hated television, so I really had to sneak my television viewing. You know,
she could focus all her attention on you, too.
Oh,
right?
Yes. She had nobody to, yes, subdivide the attention. So it was all very laser beam on me.
How did you discover performing?
I think the elementary school called my mom and told her that I was talking to myself on the playground at recess. I wasn't playing with any kids. I didn't really have any friends. And so they
What
thought,
age was this?
This was probably like third grade, I think. And I just kind of remember, walking around by myself and talking to myself. And so that my mom got this call from the school saying she doesn't have any friends. And my mom thought, well, she's very dramatic about everything, and everything is sort of in histrionics, so maybe she'll like acting. So she found a local acting class for me and signed me up, and I just immediately fell in love.
What was it you fell in love with?
I think there was a couple of things. One, I think I was good at it, and so it was like, I'm not athletic. I didn't have really great like social skills, so I think it was a place where I was like, oh, I'm naturally good at this. And then also, it was a far more accepting social environment than my school. So I actually had friends there at my acting class.
So you really didn't have friends at school?
Not really. Like, I had two separate best friends in elementary school who both sort of ditched me because I was unpopular, and they both wanted to be popular, so they sort of cut me off.
That's so terrible.
Yeah, so that happened twice.
I think about that with my daughters, too, like... And yet I also believe firmly that anyone who had trouble at that age goes on to a more interesting life. I believe that.
I'm glad for all of those experiences because I felt like it made me an individual. I didn't concede really to the social pressure to be like everybody else. I was defiant about being different. And I think, you know, now as an adult, that's what I like about myself.
Right.
But as a kid, that's not always really rewarded, you know? I found at acting class, the kids were nice to me. It was also kids from all over the city. It wasn't just kids from my suburb.
Right.
So I felt like I got to meet kids who lived in different neighborhoods and went to different schools, and I think I really liked that as well. And
was it almost like two lives? Like you had your life at school, and then you got to go to this other.
Yes, I lived for Saturday.
You did.
You know, as I got older, I would take more and more classes, so it became a full day thing where I'd take like jazz dance, and I'd have a singing class, and I've had an acting class, and it became this. My full Saturday was at the Pittsburgh Playhouse, which was a great place.
Yeah.
That was my whole real social life, I think.
And was there a point when you were like, I'm going to do this for my life?
Well, it's interesting because there were a lot of kids in Pittsburgh who all were very serious about acting. And so it was kind of you were following the roadmap that other kids older than you did, which was like you took classes at the Playhouse And then you auditioned for these theaters. There were a couple of musical theaters in Pittsburgh that always hired kids.
So when I was a kid, I didn't know Juilliard existed.
Yeah, I didn't either.
You didn't?
No.
So how do you end up on that path and on a very dramatic path?
Yeah, well, like all the other kids in Pittsburgh, my goal was to go to Carnegie Mellon University, which has a very good acting program. And my mom actually started working there when I was in seventh grade so I could go there for free, because you had to work there for 6 years before your children could get free tuition.
So she didn't shelter you at all, did she?
But then...
Wow. And she could be there at college with
you.
Oh,
yeah, which I realized. Yeah, so I I would go and I would sit in on acting classes there when I was in high school, because my acting teacher taught freshman and sophomore acting there. So I met all these actors who are now incredibly successful when I was in, like, high school, and I was, like, the weird 13-year-old in the back of the class, you know. I remember, like, seeing Matt Bomer as a freshman at Carnegie Mellon, and I was just, like, had the biggest crush on Matt Bomer. And all these people, you know, that I first met when I was in high school, and I was, like, I'm sure they're like, who is this kid who's, like, sitting, you know, in the corner not speaking in our acting class? But, yeah, so that was my whole goal was to go to Carnegie Mellon. And then I think, A, I realized that my mom was going to come and find me every single day on campus if I went there. And then someone said, sort of offhandedly, you should audition for Juilliard, which I don't remember having really any awareness of it.
Right.
It wasn't, like, something that I had as a goal or people really talked about. But someone said, you should audition, and so I was like, okay, and I did, and then I got in.
So when you get to Juilliard, how are the expectations different than the reality?
Oh, my gosh. Well, you sort of feel like the hard part's over, you got in.
Right.
And then you realize it's sort of that cliche of, like, look to your left, look to your right, one of you is not going to be here when this ends, because when I was there, they had a cut program, which I think, thankfully, they've gotten rid of. But you went in knowing, once you got there, you realized, oh, they cut one person from every sophomore class. It wasn't like a quota system where they had to cut a certain percentage like other acting programs, but every year that I was there, at least one person from the sophomore class was cut. So then suddenly you realize, like, oh, it's not guaranteed that I'm going to graduate.
Right.
And then the worst case scenario happened to me. I was put on probation, so it's your sophomore year right before the Christmas break. There were these bulletin boards in the hallways where they would have, you know, notes about class schedules or whatever, and they would put up these yellow envelopes, and everybody sort of knew whoever's name was on this yellow envelope was going to be on probation. So I think there were probably like five of us, and my name was on it. And then you would go, and they had the entire faculty in this office, and you sat in a circle, and each member of the faculty went around and told you how you were failing in their class.
Oh, my God, that's horrible.
We already had these brutal evaluations, like once a semester, where we would do this, where we'd be in this large classroom, and the teachers would set up chairs in different corners, and you would go from teacher to teacher, and they would give you an evaluation. But generally, some people get some positive feedback. But when you're on probation, it's essentially like, you're terrible at voice and speech because of this. You're bad at movement because of this. You were terrible in this play that we did. You were not good in this acting class. You were bad in, you know, your clowning class. So it was just the
entire... You had a clowning class?
Oh, yeah. We had classical clowning.
Not so, like, it's... Yeah.
Yes, yes. You know, coming out of the commedia tradition.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, so you'd have...
That's horrible. So you're just sitting there being told you suck.
And then you go home for Christmas break.
To think about it and enjoy your holidays.
Yes. So that was a really terrible Christmas break, where I don't think my mom knew why I was, like, catatonic, essentially. But
well, you know, that's what was so heartbreaking about that letter, was that you had described always being somebody that gained strength from being obedient, following rules.
Teacher's pet, yeah.
And then here you were at this school where maybe all those things that were supposed to, that you thought would carry you through life, stopped working.
Yeah.
But the most heartbreaking part was when it happened to you, you decided to keep it in. And I read between the lines that there was like shame there something.
Oh, yeah.
That sort of describe your mindset at that time?
Yeah. I mean, you know, my dad's family in particular were very academically successful. You know, my dad was one of 13 kids. I think almost all of his siblings have an advanced degree in something. A lot of lawyers, a lot of doctors. I remember my aunts and uncles would like send their kids' report cards around the family. So I remember getting my eldest cousin's report card in the mail, and she got straight A's. She went to Harvard. My dad's five youngest siblings all went to Harvard. So,
oh my God, it was a very
serious family academically. And so already, I think I felt like, oh, I'm doing something outside of the norm. I'm the only person, who's involved in the arts. And then, oh God, am I failing at this? And then it really weighed on me that your credits wouldn't transfer. So if you were cut from Juilliard, you had to start all over again. So you had to wait to apply to college. So you're adding another year. So it's essentially three wasted years and then starting all over again somewhere else. So I'd already kind of felt conflicted about should I pursue this or not. And I think my mom was really scared about me going to an acting conservatory and really giving up a liberal arts education. And so I already felt like it was a risky move to take. And I felt at that point in my life that at like 18, I had locked myself in forever, that now I had to be an actor because I had chosen to go to Juilliard. And it kind of took away my love of acting.
Yeah, I would imagine.
For a while. And they weren't wrong about the things they were telling me. Like as a kid doing plays, you're supposed to just be very obedient. The director tells you what to do, and you do it, and you recreate it exactly. And you show up on time, and the stage manager doesn't yell at you. And so, I was very, very punctual, very respectful, very professional. And I thought that's what was most important. So I was sort of shocked by people being, sort of acting out, or I remember someone, storming out of an acting class, or people, just doing things that I thought, oh, you'd get fired immediately, if you did that in a play. Like, I would have never behaved like that in any play I was in as a kid, but that behavior was sort of tolerated. But then me sort of being kind of robotic, that sort of really got me criticism. So it really sort of upended my idea of what was important, what wasn't.
Right. At one point, did you look at it and go, wait, there's something wrong with this picture?
It really felt like I was Alice through the looking glass of, all the things that I had been told were important and valuable were suddenly not important. And it was like a real, I guess, an omen of how much bad behavior is tolerated for actors.
Right,
it's like there's a lot of things that are let slide. But I was just, I was taught as a kid, if you're on time, you're late. You hang up your clothes because you respect your clothes and you respect your props and you put them back where, and you you do everything, you sign in when you get to the theater. And, so I was so used to doing everything by the book and being told by stage managers and directors and acting teacher that I was a good kid.
You were here early today?
Yeah, I'm always early. So it was just very confusing to me when suddenly that wasn't the most important thing.
I think what I hear you saying is that when you're an actor, you sort of have to live outside the boundaries a little bit and develop your own opinion, your own take on things. And there isn't necessarily going to be a director telling you everything to do.
Yes. That was incredibly valuable, that they really pushed me to have an opinion about what I was doing, to have an opinion about the character, to come in with ideas, to ask questions, to be engaged in it. That, 100%, they were right. And that has served me well. Not everybody always wants to hear your opinions as an actor, but just for me to feel like it's on me to create this character. I'm not waiting to be told what to do. But I just even remember my sophomore year, we were doing this play and the director was like, go and get yourself a costume. I was like, everything I've ever done, there's been a costume designer.
Right.
So I was like, what do you mean I have to go get my own costume? You have fittings and they tell you what you look like. She was like, well, what do you think your character would wear?
And that was like,
yeah. It's huh? Go to a thrift store and find something you think your character would have an opinion about it. But it's also this hard thing of learning how to speak up. That's been a real lesson for me over the course of my career post-college. Because I think initially I just was too scared to push back against anything or say, I don't think that's right or anything.
Why do you think that is?
Once again, being obedient.
But being obedient, I wonder how that developed. I wonder if that was a coping mechanism.
Oh, 100%. That was like part of the Lenny letter when the editors would say, but why did you like following all the rules? And it was like, because it got you praise from adults. And that's all I cared about was like adults telling me that I was good. You know, so they like adults like obedient children. And so I wasn't rebellious, really, in
it's
a way.
It's funny to think, like, because you're right. That my question to that is why? Why do you think you sought praise from adults so much? I mean, does that come from, do you think, the fact that your family unit's so tiny that...
Well, yeah, I think when you kind of have a, you know, my dad was a very difficult person and wasn't, you know, really a great parent, and so it was just me and my mom, and so I felt this obligation to be good for my mom because she was already so stressed out about being a single parent, essentially supporting us on her own, working a full-time job. So it was like she didn't have any room for me to act out. So I kind of knew as a kid, like, she can't handle you to be a rebellious child.
That's a very mature understanding for a kid.
Well, you know, my mom's not an addict, but my dad certainly was, and I think it is a common theme among children of addicts that you sort of learn these coping mechanisms that kind of will serve you well in childhood or in these kind of stressful situations, but then you realize, kind of as I learned, that they're not really helpful as adults.
It's fascinating that with that situation growing up, that not only do you become an actor, but you end up in Juilliard where all this stuff gets sort of, you have to face it all.
Yeah.
And you come into it sort of the polar opposite from a lot of people that come to acting, which is like the rebellious, free thinking, like, I don't care what you know.
Oh, I remember other people in my class saying, like, I'm so happy I never have to take another academic class again. I was like, I miss English class. So I would go, you know, on my break, I would go to the library and read novels. And after my freshman and sophomore years of college, I went during the summer and took academic classes at different universities just because I missed being in an academic environment. There's no campus at Juilliard. It's one building.
Right.
You know, so I wanted to be on a campus. I wanted to be in a lecture hall. I wanted to, you know, have to write a paper and, you know, be in a discussion group and all these things. So, yeah, I was, I think, probably the only person there who was voluntarily taking academic classes on our summer breaks.
God, it sounds like you were in a place where you hated it for a while.
I hated it, yes. You know, it's an interesting thing when you go to a place that is prestigious like Juilliard because people
are
like,
I must be the problem.
Right? Yeah, and also other people sort of projecting how great they think it must be onto you. So like, oh my God, you went to Juilliard, and you feel kind of strange being like, I really didn't like it there very much.
Right.
But like you said, I did have so much shame about being on probation that I didn't really talk about it with anybody who was there.
Even though, so lonely.
Yeah.
I just picture you not having anyone to confide in.
Yeah, and you kind of just feel under a microscope then with the teachers, like they're watching you every moment of the class, and you, even though they're not supposed to talk about it, everyone realized fairly quickly who was on probation. And so then you kind of feel your fellow students sort of looking at you differently now.
Dead man walking.
Yeah. You know, and you know at least one person's going to be cut. So it's sort of like the five of us. We're all sort of in this together.
Right.
We know one person's going to be cut. We don't know who it is. It could be more than one, but it's always been one. So it's an odd experience. And then they're saying to you, but this is a safe place to fail. We really want you to take risks and feel free and go for it. And you're like, but you're judging my every move and you're telling me that I'm subpar. So why would I feel comfortable? You know, I feel...
Yeah, it doesn't sound like they built you up at all.
Well, and they also will say then, like, see how great you did? Like, after I survived it, my junior and senior year, they would go, like, look at what good it did you. Look, you're still here. You're doing great. I'm like, I'm doing great in spite of probation. Probation did not help me. They really eroded my self-confidence. I didn't think I could act on stage anymore. You know, a lot of people who go to Juilliard, they're just so reverential of the theater that when they graduate, they only want to do plays. And I was like, I don't think I can act on stage because I've been so criticized on stage, but they hate film and TV. They look down on it. They never really told me I couldn't do that, so I'll just audition for film and TV. So unlike some people, you know, who went there, I was like, I'm going to focus on film and TV consciously.
It seems like that if an acting school is not helping you with your confidence,
yeah.
they're missing the biggest key to what acting is.
Yeah, it was. I remember Juilliard's in Lincoln Center, and I remember not long after I graduated going to audition for a play at Lincoln Center, and just being in that close proximity to the school, my knees started shaking, like in the.
Really?
Yes. So it gave me a real kind of like aversion to the place.
Well, we're putting them on notice right here.
I'm
right?
sure I'm their least favorite alum because of this essay that I've written.
Except you're fantastically successful. So at that point, did you have a plan for your career, or was it just like, I have to get work? I mean, were you broke? Were you living on your own?
Yes, I was definitely broke. I thankfully had some good instincts about people. I'm still with the same manager who I signed with right when I graduated from college.
Oh, wow.
I'm at the same agency. I've had the same lawyer my entire career, the same publicist my entire career. So I think I didn't really know what I was doing. That was another thing that I was kind of shocked by, was that Juilliard didn't really know anything about agents or managers. They couldn't really guide you as to what was a good place, what was a bad place.
Right.
And we would start to have your junior year. You know, agents and managers and casting people would start to kind of come to your plays, and sometimes you would get one of those yellow envelopes, but this time it was saying, this person wants to meet you. And I remember going to them and saying, like, Three Arts wants to meet with me. I don't know. Who are they? And they're like, oh, we don't know. And, you know, looking back, it's a great management company. But I had no idea who they were. But thankfully, I had a good enough people instincts that I think I chose well. So that part of my career kind of worked itself out pretty quickly. And I know a lot of people who bounce from agent to agent, you know, early on in their career or really struggling to get representation. And that was the benefit of Juilliard, was that people came to see you. You had a real shot at getting representation. Casting directors came to see you. And then, you know, when you're first starting out and your agent's pitching you and they're saying she's a Juilliard grad, more often than not, they're going to take the audition.
Those are the years that really probably define an artist, is how do you cope with the inability to work, or the having to wait to do the thing you love or to do the thing you're meant to do until someone hires you.
And yes.
Just describe a little bit of that time when you're sort of an unmoored actor trying to find work, and how you deal with that.
Well, I didn't know what I was good at, really. And then you're also like, it's a really interesting thing because so many parts that I auditioned for initially, I was still auditioning for like high school and college parts. And a lot of those parts are for very conniving, sexually manipulative teenage girls.
Oddly. Yeah.
Very overrepresented by male writers, screenwriters. It's just sort of like everyone is this Lolita who's like trying to ruin some male, unassuming male teacher's life. Like, it was just, you know, script after script. And I was like, even the most popular, confident, sexual girl at my high school was not, like, cunning in this way. There was, you know, but so many parts like this. And I was so kind of sheltered, I didn't even know how to flirt. So I remember getting scenes for auditions and being like, it says she's flirting, but I don't know what to do. So you're like trying to figure out what it means to flirt. Because whatever flirting I was doing was just kind of like the awkward nerd meets nerd, like, hey, have you read that book? You know, like it was not, you know, I was not sidling up to anyone, you know. So I remember consciously telling my mom, we have to go get me revealing clothes for these auditions. So like going and buying low cut tops and short skirts and buying heels, which
you were a complete innocent.
Yeah, I did not know what I was doing. So, you know, you're like, this is my audition shirt that I would never wear. And I remember I would like wear a zip up hoodie, you know, because I was embarrassed to be seen in the shirt, and then just sort of unzip it and take it off for the audition. And then the audition was over and zip it back up again. And I'm sure looking back, I looked ridiculous, and I didn't need to do that necessarily. But in my mind, that's what I thought I had to do when someone said, you should wear the color blue for audition. So I was like, Mom, we got to get all these blue shirts. So I had all these
blue shirts, low cut.
Low cut blue shirts.
It's the key to success.
Yeah, and I remember.
Take note, people.
Take note. But, you know, yeah, people would say, thankfully, I didn't have a lot of really terrible casting experiences, and I think that's also because I had, you know, reputable agents and managers who were sending me out on hopefully things that weren't like that. But even still, I remember auditioning for this movie, and I was still living in New York, and you know, as an actress in New York, you're sort of battling the elements at all times. It's like either snowing or it's raining or it's super hot and you're sweating. And so you try and get yourself ready in your apartment, and then you go through the New York subway system and you come out on the other end looking a little bedraggled. And so we'd all be trying to put ourselves back together in the bathroom at whatever casting office. But in LA, you can kind of like do it, get in the car, it's pristine, you walk out and you're, you sort of look very put together. So, you know, I had done my best. I'm not really good at doing my own hair and makeup. And I remember the casting director saying to me, "You girls in New York, you know how to act, but you don't know how to do this. And the girls in LA, they look perfect, but I got to teach them how to act." And he said, "I want to bring you in for the director, but I know what he's going to say. He's going to say not pretty enough. So you need to fix this and like gesture, like hoist your boobs up." And okay.
Talk about building your confidence up right before you go in.
Yeah. Well, this was like a pre-read, you know, because like he wasn't about to bring me in to the director looking the way I was looking.
Until you fix this.
Until I fix this. And so I like went to the Bobby Brown counter at Barney's and paid them to do my makeup. And, you know, I used to do that all the time because I didn't know how to really do my makeup. So if it was a big audition, I would go to Barney's and like pay them.
Oh, my God.
They became my buddies. They knew me and my mom, and you could get like a SAG discount on the makeup. And
really?
Yeah. You develop tricks as an actor. I'd like go to the dry bar and get a blowout, and I bought a push-up bra and went back in and did not get the part. But
oh, yeah. God.
But I think every actress has stories like that, you know.
Sure, but I would think that, you know, the business is littered with stories like that that are demoralizing enough that it just pushes people out.
It does. That was another thing I think I realized. One of the other things that Juilliard gave me was like, okay, I'm not the most talented, but I'm going to be the most practical. I'm going to try and always take like a 1,000-foot view of this business in my career. So I realized it's a profession of attrition. So part of it is just hanging in there. And I just would watch a lot of people that I knew fall out. They couldn't take it. It was too sensitive. It was too harsh. It was too demoralizing. And I was like, part of this is just hanging in. And I'm not going to take this personally when I don't get a job. And I'm not going to let it, you know, destroy me. And I was just always thought, I'll just be very practical. Even if I'm not the most talented, I will be very like calm and, you know, even keeled about this whole thing. And that will carry me.
What do you think kept you going?
Once again, feeling like I didn't have any other options. I didn't have an education. I didn't think I could get into grad school for something else. I thought, you know, I'm stuck being an actor.
Isn't that funny? Because usually people think, oh, I would love to act, but I'm stuck in my real job.
Yeah.
And you had the reverse.
Yeah, I felt very stuck.
That's amazing to me.
And I didn't know if I still liked acting. And also, as you said, when you're first starting out, you're sort of waiting to be given permission to act. So you're not really spending that much time acting.
Right.
And I had such a bad time at Juilliard that I didn't want to take acting classes after I graduated. So a lot of people are honing their craft. They're getting to act by doing scenes and working with teachers and everything. And so that gives them a regular opportunity to act. And for me, I just didn't want to be anywhere near a classroom. So I wasn't doing any of that either.
Must have been a lonely time.
It was, especially when I would come to LA because I didn't really know anyone here. I didn't really know the city. I would just really only meet people that I was auditioning against, and that's not the friendliest, warmest way to meet people. And then I would just like go, I just remember, I'm a person of routine, you might guess. And so I just like got a few places in my head of like, I go there and I go there and I go there, and I look back and I'm like, why? Why would I always go there? Why would I go read books at the La Brea Tar Pit, where it's got like the noxious fumes of tar seeping up from the ground?
You didn't know any other place.
I didn't know where to go. There was no Central Park in LA. You know, I kept looking for like the New York equivalents, of which there really weren't.
No.
I would go to Book Soup and just hang out, or I would go to the Beverly Hills Public Library. That's where I would go hang out.
Well, okay, so I wasn't a big TV watcher during the period of community mm-hmm. because we had little kids and there just wasn't the time. And when I saw Don't Think Twice, it took me a minute to put together, you know, who you were.
Yeah.
And also because you look so different. And
I've stopped dyeing my hair.
Well, and I think and I think community, it just, you know, being on a network show like that, it's a different vibe.
And then
when I saw Don't Think Twice, my first assumption was that Mike Birbiglia had hired all pro improv people, mm-hmm. right? Because why wouldn't he? He's doing a movie about improv,
yes.
and there's a lot of actors that do improv. And I was amazed to find out that that was not your background.
Yes.
And just briefly, it's about a troupe of improv people in New York, and their company is sort of a breeding ground or a minor leagues for the fictional equivalent of Saturday Night Live. Your boyfriend is played by Keegan-Michael Key, who gets an audition to that Saturday Night Live show called Weekend Live, and that sort of splits the group apart. And it's so believable that you almost feel like you're watching a documentary mm-hmm. when you're watching this film. But after finding out you didn't do improv, and then sitting here with you today, I would think that doing a film like that would qualify at the top of the list of scaring yourself.
Exactly. Well, that when you said at the beginning that I was looking to do things that scared me, that was what terrified me about that movie.
What was the emphasis for scaring yourself?
Well, you know, you sort of feel like you get good at one thing and then people just sort of want you to do that over and over again.
Is that what you found after Community, that that's how people saw you? Oh, she's great in a half-hour sitcom, network.
Yeah, but, you know, for me starting that out, that was incredibly scary because I didn't have a comedy background.
Right.
So I was in a cast with people who had gone to UCB, had done Groundlings, had stand-up backgrounds, were, you know, so good at comedy, and I wasn't. I didn't know how to sell a joke. I didn't know how to do a physical bit. I didn't really know a lot of the technical things sometimes that really make comedy work. And so I would just get so intimidated every time I would get a script, that first season especially, and they had given me something to do. I was like, I don't know how to do this. But then, of course, you know, over the course of 6 seasons, I got more confident at it. And so then it's like, oh, everyone just thinks of me for comedy. But previous to that, I'd only done drama. I'd done very humorless drama. And so then Don't Think Twice was interesting because, yes, it's about people doing comedy, but it's not really a comedy. The film isn't a comedy. So for me, I felt like it was good, A, because doing improv in the film scared the crap out of me, and my character was supposed to be the best at it. So
right. Your character plays the woman who represents the purity of improv and who loves the idea of the shared
art for art's
art
sake.
Form. Yeah. Yes, and the improv is an art unto itself
yes.
and not a stepping stone to sketch comedy on TV.
Yeah.
And when I hear you say this, I realize you've basically been scaring yourself your whole life.
Yeah, I guess so.
So what were you weighing when you got offered the role? Mm-hmm. Like, did you have to think about it before saying yes?
Well, I thought this is a character that is closer to me than a lot of the parts I've played before, but interestingly, not someone I've really played before. So it was like she's a sort of more normal human being. And, you know, I've played a lot of people who are so dissimilar to me as a person that it was a kind of interesting challenge to play somebody maybe a little bit closer to me.
She's very grounded,
yeah.
This woman.
And I was a very, you know, idealistic kid and teenager and loved things in that way that my character Sam loves improv. So I really felt like I related to that. But then on the other hand, it's like the prospect of having to do improv in the film and having to do it next to Keegan-Michael Key and next to Chris Gethard, who's incredible, and Tammy Sager, who's amazing, and Mike and Kate Micucci, who's part of this like very famous comedy duo. So that to me was like I could really fall on my face here, and if I'm not believable as like if not the best in this group, one of the best, the story will not make sense.
Right.
So that was an enormous amount of pressure. And I remember before I went to New York to start working on it, two of my castmates from Community, Jim Rash and Danny Pudi, were doing improv at the IO, Improv Olympics, a theater in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And so I said, oh, well, I'll come and watch you guys because I need to start going to see improv shows because I'm about to do this movie. And they're like, well, come up on stage. And I was so scared that I hid behind a pillar on the side of the stage for the whole show. And I was thinking, what are you doing? You're about to have to go do this on camera you know, for real, and you're so scared you can't even do it at this tiny theater with two of your closest friends on stage with you. So it was really scary. I hadn't felt my heart like pound like that in a while when we were doing these improv shows in New York and taking these classes. And Mike just sort of threw us out there. And he says he told us ahead of time. I either blocked it out or he didn't, but he was having us just do improv shows at the Upright Citizens Brigade in New York for paying audiences who are coming in expecting, like, world-class improv.
I'm assuming that you probably went pretty deep in your research, too, about the Del Close's book and the theory of improv, and I would think that that would be, you know, intimidating.
Yes.
To see all, like, and I wonder if the Juilliard thing of them telling you that you weren't good on stage.
Well, yeah, and also telling, sort of saying at Juilliard that comedy was unimportant. Like, it wasn't.
So you never studied it?
No. I remember I did one scene my sophomore year that was like a Chris Durang play, and it was funny, and it got laughs, and my classmates were laughing, and they really liked what I did, and it was the most positive response I'd ever gotten. And I remember the teacher saying, like, well, you can clearly do that, so never bring in anything like that again. So it was like,
oh, really?
Yeah, it was not like a school that was like, hey, she's funny. Why don't we, like, have her do some more comedy, or, like, that could be really valuable to her career, or, you know, that.
Yeah, that's like they see Michael Jordan play a little one-on-one. They're like, well, that comes easy to you. Why don't you go try soccer?
Yeah, because it's like comedy to them is like, you know, doing, like, Moliere or something, you know?
Right, right.
It was not like anyone was saying you should aspire to being on 30 Rock, you know, or you should aspire to doing, you know, these shows that I fell in love with as a viewer and thought were like, oh my God, The Office and
sure.
All these shows that I would watch all the time. That was not something that was, like, held up as, like, a goal at school. So yeah, I never studied comedy. Unlike so many of these other people, I didn't have a background in it. I didn't have a stand-up background, a sketch comedy background, an improv background. And so it was this weird moment where people now associate me with comedy, but I don't really have the training that most of these other people do.
Well, now I associate you with improv.
Oh, great.
And you must finally understand that you're talented now after doing that film, because, I mean, there's a scene at the midway point through the film where you are... You're rehearsing for your audition for Weekend Live, and you're trying to channel Katharine Hepburn.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of a peek behind the curtain at what an actor does. I mean, were you able to bring some of those things into the film?
Well, it was interesting because in the script, I think it said I was doing like a Kate Winslet impression. And I was like, I don't know, I'm not really that great at accents. And Mike said, well, who do you think you could do? And I was like, well, I was obsessed with Katharine Hepburn as a kid. I think I could do a Katharine Hepburn. So I tried to pull it a little bit closer to myself so that I would feel more confident about doing it. But yeah, I've never really studied someone in that way that I assume, you know, that everybody on SNL does. That was never anything. I've never played a real person.
Right.
So that was a first for me. But, and you're just genuinely, like, seeing me trying to learn her accent and mannerisms.
But I think that it's an amazing look at that process, too.
Yeah.
And you're so good at it. I mean, you do her very well. I mean, was that something you've done as an impression?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, as a kid, you know, I used to watch her movies a lot and I would read biographies of her, and I read her autobiography. And
this is part of you not having friends.
This is part of me not having friends, because they didn't really want to talk about Bringing Up Baby
or which Philadelphia is a great Story. Film, by
which
the
is
way.
A great film.
Philadelphia Story is one of my favorite films of
Agreed.
All time.
Agreed. My, she was, yeah. Yeah, Cary Grant was like my first crush as a kid.
Interesting.
We didn't own that many movies, but To Catch a Thief was one of the movies we owned, so I watched that a lot. So between that and the comedies he did with Katharine Hepburn, I was, like, really into Cary Grant.
So I think that, you know, I walked away from that film, from Don't Think Twice, with such a huge respect for improv actors. I think what that film does is it describes to any non-artist what it's like to really have a community of like-minded people who support you creatively.
Yeah.
And in a way, I kind of thought, like, that has to be, for an actor, it has to be the most incredible feeling to have a troupe of people and be supported and be able to go out on a limb and not being told you're failing.
Yes.
You know what I mean? I mean, that must have been kind of a fascinating experience.
Yeah, well, I definitely feel like the cast of Community was that for me.
Right.
That is one of the most supportive casts I've ever been a part of, where we really just were delighted by each other.
Right.
And we all found each other funny. And, you know, you just see people take, like, wild swings, big choices as actors, which sometimes can feel very vulnerable because what if it doesn't work and then you kind of got egg on your face and everybody's sort of looking at you. But somebody would do something, everybody would be like, that was amazing! And we would quote the show to each other and we would, like, have our own favorite alt lines that didn't make it into the final cut that we would repeat incessantly. And by the end of the show, we were sort of speaking in our own language of inside jokes. And I definitely experienced that, really, I think, for the first time working on that show.
Sounds like Community was the school you wanted Juilliard to be.
It really was. And so I learned so much from my castmates. I would just steal from them. I would see how Donald Glover sold a line, or I'd see what Jim Rash would do with something that they gave him, or, you know, you just watch not only how to, like, sell great writing, which was what we had on that show, but also how to bring more to it. And so I miss them every day.
I bet.
Yeah.
I bet. Before we get off Don't Think Twice, there's a scene at the very end where you were on stage alone, and it's such a metaphor for life, which is, yes, we all want the cocoon and the community and the troop,
yeah.
But in the end, we're sort of all alone. And there you are on stage, and you have no other improv actors with you. And it's sort of like the breakdown of this troop to the point of where you're all sort of lonely.
Yeah.
And I wondered what that was like for you.
Well, I really loved that scene. So it was really fun because it was such a challenge for me as an actor. And, you know, in the scene, my character is improvising all these different characters because she's on stage by herself. So I was having to try and, like, distinguish each one of them and sort of lay out the physicality of the space. And there's a lot in improv about creating your space physically. And I'm not very good at that. Like, our acting, our improv coach on the movie would be like, Gillian, you set up a table there and then you just walked right through it, like, a minute later, you know? So right. I would to, like, consciously think about the fact that I've, like, the character's in a well and I've placed the well here. So if I'm not in the well, I have to be here or here, you know? So there's all these technical things that you're doing, but then it's also, like, turns into a very emotional scene
as
the scene goes on. So when you're doing an indie film like that, you have such limited time. You know, when you're doing a studio movie, you can spend, like, all day on a scene like that. But on an indie film, you really are under the gun, so you feel like this pressure that you got to get it, and you got to get it as soon as possible, because then we got to move on.
Yeah.
But it was fun. It was, you know, you don't, when you're not the most famous actor in the world, you don't always get the most challenging acting parts, you know? So you really relish those opportunities when you have a character like that or you have a scene like that that you feel like challenges you in that way.
I want to talk about your show, Love, on Netflix. Judd Apatow, executive producer, and Paul Rust, who plays your co-star, who also wrote it and was a creator on
it. Yes, he and Leslie Arfin and Paul and Judd created the show.
Right. So this show, it's incredible. It's one of the most real things I've ever seen on television in terms of that period in your life, which I relate to because I was a photographer and a musician trying to make it in Los Angeles,
yeah,
and living in Hollywood. And it sort of lives in that place where you don't have the responsibilities of adults yet, but you're not kids and you don't have your parents there for guidance anymore. You're trying to make it work and you sort of have to be, you sort of have to face your shortcomings,
yes,
for the first time, knowing that if you don't get your shit together, it's not going to happen for you.
Yes.
You play a love and sex addict, alcoholic, drug-taking, smoking woman who has a poor relationship with her father and who is can be a really mean, cutting person who like burns the town down and walks onto the new town.
Yeah.
So I think what's mysterious to me is, do I find myself so connected to a show when it works because the actors have invested so much into creating a character or because they've put so much of themselves into the character?
I mean, on the surface, I have almost nothing in common with Mickey, the character that I play on Love. I don't drink, I don't smoke, I've never done drugs.
Which, when I found that out, I was fascinated to find out that you've never had a drink.
Yes, I've never had a drink.
Good for you.
Thank you.
Yeah. That's pure gin.
That's pure.
So
is that what gin looks like? I don't
that's
even
what
know.
It tastes like.
Okay. Yes, so I wouldn't say that there's so much of me in the character, other than you bring your sort of human empathy and vulnerability to a character. I would say that's what I tried to bring to Mickey. Like, I do feel like I understand why she's doing what she's doing, even if it's not something I would ever do. So that's, I feel like, the part of me that I bring is my empathy and my compassion and my understanding. But I don't feel like she's very close to me at all in terms of her behavior or her external characteristics.
No, and I agree with that. And obviously, that's acting. But
yeah,
there is a relatability there that comes from empathetically being able to understand that. And there must be, I mean, to me, I look at it and I go, there must be crossover points between the two of you.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of feel like Mickey is me at the worst time in my life if I'd never gotten therapy and made some different choices. You know, I have a lot of addiction in my family, and I think I very consciously chose not to drink because of that.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask. I mean, is Mickey sort of the cautionary tale that that your mom warned you about, of the girl you could become?
Yeah, I remember my mom gave me that book, Go Ask Alice, which is like that histrionic, like, I don't think it's true. They say it's like the diary of an anonymous girl who basically, I feel like, smokes weed once and it ruins her entire life. It's like,
right,
you know, it's like one of those, like,
your mom was
oh yeah,
she was spot on with her manipulations.
And I took to it. I mean, that I was like primed for that book of like, do drugs once and it'll ruin your life forever. So yeah, I was very like rigid and like, I'm never gonna drink, I'm never gonna do drugs, I'm never, like, I remember my cousin took me to a house party when I was in high school and people were smoking weed and I was so scared that I would get a contact high that I was trying to hold my breath in this house party full of like high school students. So yeah, but maybe if I had had like a different attitude towards it, I mean, I don't know if I have a predilection towards addiction because I've never allowed myself to try anything.
Isn't that interesting?
You know, so I remember a therapist telling me that I was like, I kind of lived like a dry drunk because my life was being controlled by drugs and alcohol, but I wasn't engaging in them, you know, but like the fear of them was sort of shaping my decision making.
Right.
So it's like I still have that very, you know, charged relationship to substances even though I've never done them.
Well, this is me putting things together in my own mind, but I listened to this podcast that you did, and it was with like someone you'd grown up with in Pittsburgh.
Oh, Steve Bazelon.
Steve Bazelon.
Yeah, terribly funny.
Terribly funny.
Yes.
And it was sort of an amazing conversation. And you spoke about your father, and I think he had died fairly recently when you...
A couple years ago. Yeah.
And maybe this is just me being a dad and thinking about how my relationship is going to go as my girls get older and stuff. But last night I watched an episode where Daniel Stern plays your father.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help but think of what you discussed on that podcast and what I was watching on screen.
Yeah, I was stunned when I read that script for the first time because there were so many parallels to my father that I had never told the writers on the show about. So that was like kind of shocking to me.
That's the part where you feel like you're just watching real life take place in front of you.
Yeah.
I think there's a scene of, and you're in a bar and you're sitting between your boyfriend, played by Paul Rust, and Daniel Stern, who plays your father, and you have this mix of emotions that are completely readable to the audience of shame, humiliation, fear, a need for acceptance, and it's all crossing you at the same time, and it's so complex. And I would just think, as an actor, that's either the hardest thing in the world to do, or you just give yourself over to the story and infuse your own life into it.
Well, it's interesting because you would sort of think if something is that close to your real life, that must make it easier, but it doesn't really work like that.
It doesn't.
I mean, in some ways, it's like I didn't really have to have anyone explain anything about that episode to me,
right.
You know? But on the other hand, it's still like there's enough difference between me and Mickey, and this is not my dad. This is an actor, and this is a character that the writers have created that... it's still acting, but yeah, you do sort of like, I do remember there was just this, I think there's this point in the episode where I like say like, I love you, Dad, or something like that. And I realize like, oh, I'll never say that again to my dad in real life because
oh, yeah,
my dad has died. So that is just sort of like, you know, you have moments like that as an actor where something sort of just like hits you so deeply that doesn't even necessarily have anything to do with the character or the scene that you're playing, but it just sort of like lines up to your life, or like this is a character who's still grappling with this relationship with their parent, and because my dad has passed away, that door is really shut on our relationship. It's a
right.
It's a fixed thing. It can't ever get any better. It can't ever get any worse. It can't change. So that was like a sort of shocking moment. And you kind of never know as an actor when those are going to sort of hit you.
Yeah, you can't know, right?
It's no. Just,
well, from listening to that podcast, I got the sense that on the surface, he was around a lot and would show up at your plays and mm-hmm. would encourage you to be an actor. And yet there was a whole lot of ways that he wasn't there for you.
Well, certainly I took his addiction personally, which I think a lot of children of addicts do.
Right.
Where you're sort of taught, like, if only he loved me more, if only he cared enough about me, if only I was important enough to him, then he would get it together. And that's really not how addiction works. And so I wish that I had realized that at a younger age, because you're just so constantly disappointed by your parent. And you take everything as a sign of, like, their lack of love and care for you, when really they're a person who's grappling with an addiction. But, you know, as a kid, it's like, well, why isn't he responsible enough to get a job to help support me financially? Why doesn't he care enough about me, you know, to participate in meaningful ways in my life? You know, like, I would go spend the weekend at his house and I would come back home with, like, gum in my hair and he would have fed me Lucky Charms and Ho-Hos. You know, it's like, he couldn't, you know, I couldn't ever picture him as, like, a dad who got me ready for school and dropped me off. Like, I don't think he could have packed a lunch and made sure I was dressed and, you know.
It was the day-to-day stuff.
Yeah, he couldn't do any of those things, really. But I don't know, like, if he came from a generation where that was really expected of dads as much. I feel like fathers are far more involved in their children's lives now. And I think he had a father that was sort of like, there, you know, and there were 13 of them. And my grandmother, I think, you know, essentially raised the kids and my grandfather worked. And so, you know, if you have that kind of model for parenting, I don't know, how involved do you think you have to be as a parent? But I wish I would have been, and also I feel like I was sort of told as a child that I was the only one who could get through to him. I was the only one he would listen to.
Oh, so that sounds like it's become your responsibility.
Yes. And so as a child, you're trying to parent your parents. You're trying to, once again, it's telling you if only they cared enough about you, they would behave better. You can control other people's behavior, which I think is a real falsehood.
Yeah.
And so I feel like it gave me a lot of bad ideas. And just feeling like the need to try to control situations, which I think, you know, is a common thing among children of addicts. You're like, there's just sort of this, like, chaos underneath everything, this anger, this dysfunction, this unpredictability of it. And so you think if only you're good enough and you follow all the rules and you don't make them mad or you don't disappoint them, then everything's going to be okay. But that's never really true. But you're still just trying to, like, hold on tight. So I wish I had gone easier on myself, realized that there's nothing I could really do to change his behavior in the long term. That had to come from him. And that it's not my job in life to try to change other people or control situations.
Right. Well, first off, I'm amazed that you dealt with all of this and sort of found your way to be this, you know, extremely deeply talented artist. But at the same time, I also wonder, like, what it is about that situation that made you such a good actor, too.
I mean, that's something my therapist said to me, is that, like, you know, you don't know what parts of your life made you who you are.
Right.
So I can't ultimately be resentful of anything, you know, with regards to my father, because I think it gave me some of the qualities that I like about myself.
Yeah.
I did develop a real strong sense of myself. And that, you know, I felt like he had some kind of sexist ideas and sort of thought girls should just, the most important thing was how you looked. And I didn't really feel like he valued my intelligence, but rather giving into that, I was very defiant of my dad
right.
in those ways. And so I had him to push up against. So I don't know if I would be the person that I am now if I hadn't had him to kind of be in opposition too, but then you got to try and let go of some of the bad habits that it's given you.
Right.
You know, but I do believe that there are aspects of my personality that were shaped because I had a challenging father, so I can't be entirely mad about it.
Well, God, you know, I could talk to you about this forever because it's fascinating to me, and I just love the work you're doing.
Oh, thank you.
I hope Love goes on for many seasons, and thank you for coming in. And
oh, my pleasure. Thank
so
you. No, it's great. It's so nice to have such a thoughtful conversation.
Well, thank you for doing it.
My pleasure.
Well, folks, that's our show for today. It was an honor and a pleasure to sit down with Gillian. And if you haven't seen the series Love on Netflix, I definitely recommend you go see it because it's great. And if by chance you missed the film Don't Think Twice, I urge you to run, not walk, to your nearest internet streaming portal and start watching that movie because it's like nothing else that came out last year. And hey, if you're enjoying what we're doing here at Off Camera, take a minute and go to offcamera.com. One great way to support the show and also get your weekly fix of off-camera delivered right to your door is through the Off-Camera magazine. That's right, we make an exclusive, limited edition zine for every guest that comes on the show, and it'll spruce up any coffee table and provide some great reading about the guests that you're hearing about on the show. Also, if you haven't yet subscribed to the podcast, why not? Take a minute, subscribe, so that each week an off-camera can show up into your feed without you having to do anything. And please tell your friends about it too. I am Sam at offcamera.com if you'd like to send me a letter. You can also see us on Twitter at Offcamera Show or at Sam Jones, and at Instagram at Offcamera Show and at Sam Jones Pictures. So join the conversation, check out what we're doing, and we'll see you next week when I sit down with comedian Jerrod Carmichael.
The perception of comedy a lot of times is so dismissive. It's marketed in this style of a court jester. I just never see it like that. It's not all about laughs. You know, I think about guys that I regard as philosophers. I'd see comics as being like a lot of times the smartest guys in the room.
One of the fastest rising, freshest voices in comedy. He had to be talked into trying stand-up and moved to Los Angeles without ever having gotten up on stage. Yet his first HBO special was directed by Spike Lee, and now he has his own NBC sitcom. How did he do it? Not by making anyone comfortable, that's for sure. See you next time, off camera.